la mente. Entonces, la gente que es feliz no discrimina, no se fija cómo vienes, qué traes, pero la gente que es infeliz es la que está amargada, la que se está fijando no solamente en las mujeres, sino también en los hombres y en las mujeres. Vive su vida de una manera negativa siempre, ¿no?
Sí, Juchitán de Zaragoza se ha descrito como un paraíso para la comunidad mushe. Entonces, pero bueno, sí, como lo explicas, ha existido ese, se ha manifestado ese problema, ¿no? De discriminación hasta cierto grado.
Sí, aparte de que también cada vez hay una mezcla de cultura, ¿no? Tenemos gente que nos visita de Honduras, de otras partes, que vienen y se quedan, de otros pueblos que no son originarios. La gente que es zapoteca 100%, esa gente pues te acepta, es la que ha vivido toda la vida con las mujeres, son gente nuestra, pues, pero esa gente que viene a vivir, que tienen otras ideas más diferentes, entonces pues ellos no conocen nuestra cultura, no conocen nuestra forma de vida, ¿no?
Maritza, ese problema de discriminación, marginación, ¿cómo lo sientes aquí en los Estados Unidos, aquí en el área de Los Ángeles, donde tú radicas?
Híjoles, lamentablemente existe. Existe como existe en todos lados. Igual aquí en yo vivo en el área de Long Beach. Hay una parte que es muy tolerante también de la ciudad de Long Beach, pero alrededor de Long Beach, que viene siendo los lugares como Wilmington, Carson o todo eso, sí existe la discriminación. Y también existe la discriminación entre nosotros mismos, los hermanos oaxaqueños. La gente que viene del otro pueblo, del Valle de Oaxaca o de la Sierra de Oaxaca, también recibimos discriminación de ellos. Pero quizá también nosotros, yo veo como que hay una burla y discriminación. Puede ser que alguna de nosotros provocamos eso, porque también no sabemos respetar al muchacho, al hombre. Muchas de nosotros vemos uno, ay, dice, ay, qué papacito, ay, todo eso. Entonces, claro que el hombre como que se molesta, le molesta eso, y a la esposa le molesta eso, o a la novia le molesta eso. Entonces, yo creo que por eso existe la discriminación en nuestra comunidad oaxaqueña. Y en otras comunidades también existe la discriminación, muy se nota, te miran y te quizás en el anglo no es tanto como que ellos como que son un poquito más abiertos, será por la educación, yo pienso, que ellos tienen hacia el mexicano que viene de otros estados. Si ven a una chica transexual y luego pues te hacen la burla, o le dicen, mira, compa, ahí te hablan, mira, amigo, ahí te hablan, mira quién te busca, mira aquella, mira, y todo eso. Entonces sí existe la discriminación.
Sí, bueno, tenemos en la línea a Héctor Márquez. Bueno, sí, Héctor. Bueno, sí. Bueno, sí. Vale, tenemos fallas. Bueno, vamos, ahorita regresamos. Bueno, aquí tenemos un anuncio también para un próximo evento. Precisamente ahí vamos a pasar a la Vela Mushe, ¿no? Vamos a hablar de la Vela Mushe, pero antes quiero regresar con Felina. Con Felina.
¿Tenemos fallas? Pues vamos, ahorita regresamos.
Sí, bueno, Felina, ¿estás en la línea?
Sí.
Bueno, aquí tenemos un anuncio también para un próximo.
Queremos saber, Felina, ya lo dijiste, pero nuevamente, queremos saber quiénes son las auténticas, intrépidas y buscadoras de peligro.
Bueno, las auténticas, intrépidas, yo soy de la segunda generación. Ya tenemos hasta cuarta generación. Vamos a hacer 41 años de la fiesta más grande de México. Y pues desgraciadamente algunos compañeros ya se adelantaron, pero aquí seguimos en pie de lucha, invitando a la gente este 18, 19, 20 y 21 de noviembre para nuestra celebración anual, ¿no?, para que nos acompañen en Juchitán de Zaragoza, Oaxaca.
Gracias, gracias, Felina. Pues antes de continuar, por favor, Miriam, si nos puedes hablar de la Vela Mushe aquí en Los Ángeles.
Bueno, al iniciar este proyecto de Vela Mushe LA, tuvimos la primera plática con Felina. Si recuerdas, Felina, platicamos acerca de esto y quisimos hacerla muy cerca de la Vela de las Intrépidas como un homenaje a este gran trabajo que hacen las Mushes en Juchitán. Entonces, este es el cuarto año que estamos celebrando la Vela Mushe LA. Con mucho orgullo lo anunciamos, será este próximo 20 de noviembre y vamos a coronar a nuestra cuarta reina Mushe, que es la bella Noelia. Y bueno, la invitación está abierta al público a que venga y conozca esta tradición de la comunidad ismeña y ahora ya hecha en Los Ángeles, que se ha convertido no solamente de la comunidad ismeña, sino de toda la comunidad oaxaqueña y de todas las demás comunidades que les gusta nuestra cultura.
Nuevamente vamos a, por aquí me están indicando que están en la línea. Sí, bueno.
Sí, bueno, es conmigo.
Héctor, buenas noches.
Buenas noches, ¿cómo están? Mucho gusto de saludarlos,
Buenas noches, Héctor.
Mucho gusto, gracias por comunicarte con nosotros. Aquí nos dicen que tienes una pregunta, a ver.
Bueno, sí, es una pregunta para los compañeros, compañeras Mushes. Sabemos que el papel de las Mushes en el Istmo de Tehuantepec es importante porque están inmersos en un ambiente matriarcal, ¿verdad? Es una de las pocas regiones en el mundo donde hay un matriarcado muy marcado. Y queremos preguntarles, que aparte de la Vela Mushe, que es una celebración que yo los felicito todos los años, ¿qué otras actividades tienen durante el año para reivindicar este poder que tienen en Juchitán? Y ahora están acá exportados, ¿verdad? En la vida diaria, ¿qué tanto problema tienen aparte de del día que celebran una vez al año? Y recibo su respuesta en el aire y una felicitación, un abrazo grande para todos, para todas.
Muchas gracias, Héctor. Te invitamos a que compartas nuestro programa con todos tus amigos para que puedan escucharnos.
Claro. Claro que sí, por supuesto. Claro que sí, con mucho gusto.
Sí, bueno.
Sí.
Sí, Héctor.
Ajá.
Sí, sí, nada más que estábamos aquí con algunos problemitas, mi estimado Héctor, a ver si me puedes nuevamente...
No escucharon mi pregunta, ¿verdad?
A ver.
No, bueno. Estaba comentando, con Miriam la pregunta, pero no salió al aire todavía.
Sí, sí, adelante.
Okay, mi pregunta es en cuanto al contexto socioeconómico de los compañeros, compañeras Mushes, que los felicito ampliamente por su valentía y por su tradición. Decía que ya en Juchitán la realidad es una realidad principalmente matriarcal y por eso es que los compañeros Mushes, compañeras Mushes han logrado destacar en la vida diaria. Ellos tienen ciertos papeles económicos y sociales que no se le dan a los hombres, por ejemplo, nada más a las mujeres. Entonces mi pregunta es, ¿cómo trasladan esa realidad de Juchitán para acá cuando ya están en California, en la vida diaria, para que no sea nada más el festejo anual en donde se reivindican los derechos de los compañeros, compañeras transgénero? Gracias.
Le dejamos aquí la respuesta a Maritza.
Hola, Héctor, buenas noches. Yo soy Maritza
Sánchez. Gracias, Maritza. Mucho gusto, Maritza.
Mira, aquí en este país estamos, trabajamos igual que allá. Yo trabajo de mesera en un restaurante. Y igual aporto a la comunidad también como asistiendo a los eventos y apoyando en comida, en ir a apoyar a la decoración de algún lugar y todo eso a la comunidad. Entonces, en ese aspecto también estamos muy muy activas aquí también, igual que ellas allá en el Istmo.
Muy bien, muy bien.
No, pues gracias, Héctor. Por cuestiones de tiempo no podemos abarcar más. Ya estamos por terminar.
Un abrazo grande para todas, por favor. Gracias.
Igualmente, Héctor, cuídate.
Un abrazo, Héctor.
Felina, pues quiero agradecerte mucho por tu participación. Próximamente vamos a abrir un espacio más amplio para que puedan compartir sus experiencias y la problemática por la que atraviesan, ¿no? Y te agradezco mucho, Felina, por tu tiempo.
Muchísimas gracias, sí. Felina.
Sí,
suerte en la vela.
Gracias a ustedes y pues suerte, ¿no? Y estamos en contacto.
Saludos, Felina, yo soy Maritza y que tengan mucho éxito en la vela. Y estamos estamos en comunicación, igual que ustedes, ella celebrando el mismo día. Nosotros el 20, ustedes afortunados 4 días. ¡Wow! Ya quisiéramos estar allá los 4 días, ¿verdad? Pero algún día estaremos por allá.
Sí, aquí los esperamos con los brazos abiertos.
Muchísimas gracias.
Y un saludo a todos.
Gracias, hermana.
Gracias por la invitación.
Gracias, que estés bien y buenas noches.
Bueno, muchas gracias, Miriam, por tu participación. Desafortunadamente ya tenemos poco tiempo. Muchísimas gracias, Maritza. Les agradecemos bastante.
A ustedes. Gracias a ustedes. No se les olvide el 20 de noviembre, la vela Mushe.
Gracias, ¿eh?
Así es, ¿eh? Prepararse las enaguas, el todo eso y a bailar, a gozar.
Gracias. Bueno, nos despedimos diciendo que cuando el hombre blanco europeo se encontró con los nativos americanos, fue totalmente incapaz de comprender su cultura indígena o respetar su forma de vida. En lugar de valorar y contrastar las diferencias con honestidad, trató a los originarios como salvajes, menospreciando y burlándose de todo lo relativo a ellos. Nadie ignora hoy en día que se les masacró durante siglos hasta acabar convirtiendo a la fuerza a los del sur en cristianos fieles y aislando a los del norte en las famosas reservas.
Ahora nos abunda la certeza y la creencia de que todos nos enriquecemos con las personas multigénero y que todos nosotros, independientemente de nuestro origen étnico, género, sexualidad o patrimonio cultural, somos libres para ser quienes verdaderamente seamos.
Un profundo agradecimiento a todos los radioescuchas que nos han sintonizado esta noche y a los que nos siguen en vivo en nuestra página Senderos de Oaxaca en YouTube.
En la edición de esta noche escuchamos la melodía La Llorona en la voz de Lila Down y también les damos las gracias a los realizadores del documental Auténticas, Intrépidas, Buscadoras de Peligro.
Le damos las gracias a nuestro coordinador de piso, Jesús Cruz, y a Lisette Tapia. Bueno, pues nos despedimos y nos vemos.
Hi. And you are tuned to Free Radio 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. Coming up next on Free Radio is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, the October 10th edition. So stay tuned. We have lots of recent audio from your favorite downtown area, and perhaps a phone call or two. You never can tell. A couple of pieces of good news, and maybe some more. So stay tuned.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of breadlines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last-minute headlines. Dress your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you. I want a song that's satirical, putting the mirror into miracle. Or I won't love you. Sing me of kings and conferences, Marshall. Tell me of mills and mines. Sing me of courts that aren't impartial. What's to be done with them? Tell me in rhythm. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must be tense with common sense.
And welcome to Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I'm Robert Norris. This is, what it is. You're tuned to a show that you can actually call into if you wish. And the call-in number here is 427-3772. 427-FRSC. A somber announcement. Actually, not one that was unexpected. In addition to Fuhrer Trump as the new boss of the U.S., we have Free Radio Santa Cruz going off the air tomorrow on Friday, October 11th. That doesn't mean we go off the stream. Those of us who are hardy broadcasters will continue to come into the studio and do our shtick. But since it's not broadcasting, I don't know how long that's going to last. So this isn't my familiar plea to you folks out there, which is we need a place to put up the transmitter and antenna that we're taking down. It's not a really difficult deal. If you've listened to Free Radio regularly, you know that it's just a matter of attaching it to the side of a house or a tree or even a freestanding area in a backyard and with a source of electricity that we can run a cord to and get internet from. So it's also something we're willing to pay you for, but it's strangely in the last 3 years, 4 years, I don't know, a number of years anyway, we have not been able to find anyone interested in doing that. And that, I guess it doesn't make me sad, I'm kind of inured to it, but it does mean that, I keep thinking the days of free radio are coming to an end, but they may not be. Broadcast radio is the wave of the future, though it seems to me that not everybody has a computer in their car, and that radio itself is a good thing. I don't actually have a working radio in my car, but I may again soon. You never can tell. So if you have any information about where to put up a transmitter, our trusty transmitter, which we're putting into cold storage tomorrow, give a call to me on the Huff line. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. That's my organization, or one I am closely affiliated with. And I will pass on the word to the techies here at the Center of Free Radio, and we can get in touch with you and maybe kick you down a little cash, or at least the person who is actually donating the area where we can put up the free radio antenna and locate the transmitter material. And that's not, as I said, a very large area. We're not talking about a studio. We're just talking about an antenna and a small shed. So we'll cook up the shed. You provide the space. So I mentioned some good news along with the bad news lately. And since I thought both Clinton and Trump were bad news, I kind of found myself kind of being whooshed along with the majority panic and terror at the arrival of Trump. And then I go steep myself in left-wing websites like Counterpunch, which I recommend you, interesting reading, counterpunch.org. And I find myself thinking that the bad situation is not a function of Trump. It's a function of both the Democratic and the Republican parties. And Trump is exploiting it. And as the outsider, he raises the issues that people hope are going to be dealt with by someone who isn't afraid to rant and rave and abuse women and make racist remarks, as well as attack sacred cows, the foreign policy cows. One time he attacked our policy toward Israel. He attacked the policy toward Russia, in ways I agree with, by the way. But the problem is with Trump is he's such a bully in terms of the way he talks and the way he's treated his crowds of people that it's it has a fascistic look to it, and it's you know, it means perhaps the middle class will be tasting what the poorer class has been getting for a long time under so-called, you know, liberals. Like in Santa Cruz, we have liberals, or I guess they, if you want to call Cynthia Matthews a liberal, she probably calls herself a liberal, or maybe a moderate. She was reelected too, of course, as well as, I believe, although the results are not finally in on the shitty council race, as I like to characterize the body that makes the anti-homeless laws in this town. She, I think, Robert Singleton, Maxine... Is it Waters? I probably have the last name wrong. Watkins, I think it is, sorry. And sneaking in at the bottom was former Mayor Chris Crone, who will be bringing up the rear, or God knows what. He was mayor and council member for 4 years, mayor for 1 year, council member for 4 years back in around the turn of the millennium, in 1998 through 2002. And I suppose it's possible to say he was the best of a bad bunch, which isn't saying much because, as I've said before on this program, he cost the city $200,000 when he had me arrested for making a mock Nazi salute after he had imperiously closed down oral communications prematurely and threatened to arrest two other people. My response was simply to raise my arm in a mock Nazi salute and turn away and talk to someone else. I was not disrupting, but he treated that as a disruption, and that's maybe the attitude of the new council towards all kinds of things that I thought had been clarified in court rulings over the last 15 years. Was we took Crone to court for this false arrest, for which I was never charged, but I was removed from the council chambers and not allowed to speak and, you know, intimidated, handcuffed, and so forth, which shouldn't happen to people who are trying to address city council. Even people who are making remarks and gestures that the council doesn't like. And my point has always been, as I've iterated and reiterated and re-reiterated on this show, if you don't disrupt the council can't claim they're being disrupted because they don't like what you're doing or because it, quote, violates their rules. Some of which were cooked up specifically to deal with me and a few other activists who were offending the council, for example, through, I used to make a few, an occasional Nazi salute when other former mayors would act in a particularly imperious way. And it just disturbed the visual field of the city council. They didn't like to see it. And I understand, you know, who wants to see oneself criticized? But that's what the job requirement requires. So the good news I have is regarding RVs, which, as you may know, are, along with vehicles, bushes, bridges and trees under which you try to hide and during the rain are places where folks who are outside try to sleep at night and store what little property they can retain. particularly in vehicles, however, which is more of a safety spot for a person who's outdoors, is unhoused, if you will. There was a law passed by City Council a year ago under the direction of Rochelle Naroyan, but passed by most of the council, that banned RVs from, I think it was originally from 8 in the evening or 9 in the evening till 6 in the morning, something like that. And at the suggestion of one of the outgoing council members, I filed an appeal to this with the Coastal Commission because it denied people in vehicles access to the coast. And it's kind of a roundabout way of saying, you know, you're screwing over a homeless people's right to survive, but the real issue has to be, since we have to look at this from a middle-class lens, do they get a chance to go look at the view on the coast? I mean, it's ridiculous, but it's the lawyer's nonsense that you have to go through, apparently. And sometimes you get at least a temporarily positive result, and I did. The Coastal Commission staff conferred with Scott Collins on the city staff and told him that this is not going to pass muster with the Coastal Commission to have a citywide ban on RVs during so long a period, so let's work out something a little less that can slip past them. And they did. They proposed instead, and I think it passed in May, a ban from midnight to 5, I believe it was. I appealed this as well. And the Coastal Commission met in August and decided that they weren't going to okay that either, although they didn't turn it down completely. They said it was a substantial question that needed another hearing, and so far they haven't had another hearing, which leads me to the conclusion, based to some extent on my email communications with the very same Assistant City Manager, Scott Collins, who has been behind a lot of this shit against homeless people as well, other kinds of restrictions in parks and so forth, sort of pleasing the Take Back Santa Cruz crowd, that he's not going to bring it back up because the Coastal Commission, in essence, said, you know, you aren't giving us any indication that, A, there's a real public safety problem that requires this, and, B, there's no place for RVs to go and park and in the city at all anyway, so you're just driving them out. That you can't do. And also, there were some pointed comments about harassing homeless people from place to place. So it looks like poor Rochelle Naroyan and Scott Collins' proposal is, at the moment, dead in the water. I don't count on anything with Trump land and Matthews land happening in Santa Cruz for the next 2 years here and 4 years and nationally. But at the moment, RVs are legal in Santa Cruz. Of course, it's illegal to sleep in your RV at night after 11 o'clock, and it's going to be illegal to park it anywhere, or actually in many places, not anywhere, but increasingly in the so-called permit parking areas. They've added 24-hour permit parking areas in the downtown area for the first time in the last year, after apparently trying them out near the homeless lack of services center at 115 Coral Street. So, you know, again, it's interesting how that first they came, you know, for the mentally ill, and I was not mentally ill, so I did nothing. That's they came for the communists, and I wasn't a communist, I didn't do anything. And they came for the socialists, I wasn't a socialist, didn't do anything. And they came for the feminist activists, I didn't blame a feminist activist. And then there was nobody left when they came for me. Which, you know, it depends on whether you're a... it creates a very frightening situation, I think, when this whole thing attacks poor people first, because it's been traditionally okay, in fact, almost obligatory, to attack poor people because they are seen as a threat, either an aesthetic threat, oh, they blight our view, or a crime threat, oh, they took our bicycles, to, you know, those who are more well-to-do. And I'm not saying it's fun having your bike stolen. I've gotten some... people I know who I'm on a friendly basis with have had their bikes taken. Happens too much and too regularly. But when people are struggling, when law becomes simply a tool for criminalizing poor people, it becomes therefore disrespected. When community falls apart because part of the objectives of the people in power is to drive the poorest people out of town through criminalizing their very presence there, then you don't have the kind of a protective community that looks after people and property more. In fact, they do it less. I think they're, you know, they think that somehow these hired thugs in blue that walk around, and I mean people, you know, first alarm security guards and cops and rangers, are going to do that for you. You know, all you have to do is call your guardian, and he'll come rushing in and with five or six colleagues and stop that man from smoking on Pacific Avenue. I've actually seen this happen in the last 3 weeks. So, in any case, I've already talked about my victory in the city with the RVs, or the victory of the RV people. And what happened, what I learned yesterday, I think it was, or maybe the day before, I got an email on the issue of the county. Because in March, the county, following in the bad footsteps of the city, also passed an anti-RV law, this one much harsher than the city's. You would think that they would be worried once the Coastal Commission in August essentially functionally dumped the city's RV law and said that you can't do this because of the reasons I mentioned before. But instead, in August, you had the sheriff's website announcing they were going to start enforcing this law, which is a dusk to dawn ban on RVs everywhere in the county unless you have a permit. If you try to park on public property, and the permits can only come not if you kick down some extortionate money, but you have to both kick down money and it has to be associated with and parked near a local resident or business. So it's a real way of clearing out poor people who don't have somebody who wants to front for them who has a residence here, which doesn't seem to traditionally... it's hard to, you know, put a lot of stock in the word American, since that involves the slaughter of native folks and, you know, oppression of women and slavery as a historical background. And go back to that kind of background, you're not, you know, you can't really claim too much of a holy mantle. That ain't going to work too well. But it is, I think, what most Americans consider they have the right to do, which is to come into a town and park their vehicle in a public place. They're not hurting anyone. Do what they need to do and move along. And even to stay a couple of nights, a couple of days. And if they have no place to stay and their only vehicle is their home and their connections are in that town, perhaps not necessarily with people who are willing to risk animus from reactionary neighbors by having them park next to their house, they have a right to... a need that even, you know, is as deep as their right to be able to be in their vehicle without being harassed unless they're hurting someone else. And there was a lot of horse shit that was kind of thrown out to try to justify the abolition of the right, eliminating the right of RVs to park in the city. And I didn't actually get to the county's hearings, but the county covers an area that's much larger than the city of Santa Cruz and also has five times as many people. And so I sent a complaint to the Coastal Commission after I had won the Coastal Commission's essentially veto of the city's law, although, as I said, it's not really out. It's down, but it's not out. I have no doubt that the coastal staff is... in a scurried conference with the city staff, try to cook up something that will allow them to screw over poor people and yet somehow pass muster with the Coastal Commission. It might be harder to do, though, because the Coastal Commission has been pretty clear about what, at least it seemed to me in August, it said. It was rather eloquent. I think I played some of it on free radio. And you can find it on the Coastal Commission's website. Anyway, I got a letter from the Coastal Commission Enforcement Division, which had failed to advise me of anything after I'd written them twice and called them and so forth. So I wrote another long, cranky letter a few days ago that said, "What's going on? I've written you twice. The sheriff's department is enforcing all this crap, or at least on its website, it's telling people how to go after people in RVs who are parked in your neighborhood who you don't like. And this is all in violation of the right to access the coastal zone." Now, it has to be said, all of these restrictions that the city and the county now cannot impose
are only in the coastal zone, which is, I think for some reason I keep thinking it's a mile from the coast, but it probably varies. It's a sort of, I was told it goes as far from the coast as, let's say, the town clock is. But I, in my attempt to get a map of the coastal zone, I was unsuccessful back in August, and I have not tried again since. So, but there, it is a zone, and the significance of its ban in the coastal zone, which is only a small part of the city and the county, they can say, well, why not just ban it in the rest of the area? And that's what the people who came to the city council in May were demanding be done in the city. Well, if the Coastal Commission won't allow us to do it there, let's do it elsewhere. Come on, you can do it. But the city refused to do that, and it didn't really go into the reasons why, or if it did, I don't have them at the tip of my fingers, but it seems to me the most succinct and pungent reason why, the most likely reason that comes to my mind, is if you tell everybody, hey, you can ban RVs everywhere else, and the cops start, you know, giving tickets to people elsewhere in the city and in the county but not in the coastal zone, where are the vans going to go? Of course, they're going to go to the coastal zone. And that is the area that is, of course, the most highly treasured by the wealthy along the coast inside the county and inside the city. And they don't want that to happen, so they say, okay, well, you better skip the ban for the time being for both the city and the county. In any case, I got back a letter that said, oh, we certainly have been considering this, your attempt to get the county's coastal ban or ban on RVs considered, it because it denies public access to the coast. And we've decided you're correct. In fact, we have sent a letter already to the county planning department saying you can't do this. And they attached that letter, and indeed they had, although they also had a lot of suggestions as to ways they would work together to, say, do it as for more limited hours, which would have the same effect on people whose only place to sleep is their vehicle. Because if you can't park it at night in the city or the county anywhere, then you have to leave the area. And, of course, that leaves the way open for other cities and counties to do the same thing. Which is, it's just pretty horrendous, actually. It's pretty gross. It's pretty vicious. And it's not led by Trump. It's led by the locals who are now a strong majority on the city council. Yeah, real estate interests, I suppose, you know, and developer interests are part of that. Nervous neighbors who want to establish gated communities. I don't know. I wish we had a better understanding of the political factions in this town. We know about some of the pressure groups. I don't have a really clear knowledge of all the different sections in the community that they may not identify themselves as a section, but they are. I am told that 52% of the city is renters, and yet there's nothing regarding rent happening in the most powerful rent control or renter protection. The most powerful stuff that was proposed, which wasn't very powerful, was proposed by the slate that got defeated in the city council elections, the so-called new city council slate. Anyway, I sent a letter to Sheriff Hart, I think it was yesterday, that said, okay, Sheriff Hart, I want you to assure me that you have stopped all enforcement of RV bans in the county, or at least in the coastal zone part of the county. I also want you to give me a listing of all tickets you've written since that law was passed in March, and what the disposition of each ticket was, and if any were ticketed and people were fined, how that restitution is being planned for those people. Now, of course, the sheriff is not going to respond to a lot of this. He will, you know, pass the buck. Oh, we're just the sheriff. We can't tell you about the disposition of the tickets. Oh, restitution, go to the courts. But the point is made, I think, that if you run around kicking poor people, sometimes other people, if they don't, at least, even if they don't kick back, they will shout, ouch, in no uncertain terms, and create a certain amount of concern that this should not happen again, even though it probably will. So I am going to take a break for a moment, having given this half-hour tirade. But it is good news that RVs in the county and the city are although it's not legal to sleep in them at night, although people do, it is legal to park them, and is legal provided there aren't parking signs that make that impossible. But if there are parking signs in the coastal areas, I would encourage people to get in touch with me and let me know, and or to get in touch directly with the Coastal Commission's enforcement staff here, and say, you know, or just let the city know you're violating the Coastal Commission's essentially implicit ruling here that you can't pass an RV ban, you can't pass parking restrictions that amount to an RV ban at night. And there are numerous such signs around town, and that may be my next target if I'm clear enough to focus on anything these days, which sometimes I am. Let's tune in on a musical, which will no doubt disgust some and delight others, but it's one of my favorites. This is from The Roar of the Grease Paint, The Smell of the Crowd.
By the flickering flame of Mount Olympus Cocky, it's great to be back at the game. The second I saw it, I knew. I said to myself, ha-ha! I could tell at a glance that it wasn't by chance that we happened to be where we are. From the moment I woke with a lark, we were both of us singing away. And the sky was so blue, I instinctively knew we were in for a wonderful day. As I told you before, when I saw what I saw, I was terribly tempted to say, oh, no wonderful day like today. I defy any cloud to appear in the sky. Dare any raindrop to prop in my eye. On a wonderful day like today. On a wonderful morning like this. When the sun is as big as a yellow balloon. Even the sparrows are singing in tune. On a wonderful morning like this. On a morning like this, I could kiss everybody. I'm so full of love and goodwill. Let me say furthermore, I'd adore everybody to come and dine. The pleasure's mine, and I will pay the bill. May I take this occasion to say that the whole human race should go down on its knees, show that we're grateful for mornings like these, for the world's in a wonderful way. On a wonderful day like today.
On a wonderful morning like this, when the sun is as big as a yellow balloon, even the sparrows are singing in tune. On a wonderful morning like this.
On a wonderful day.
Yes, so what did you say?
A fantabulous day.
Don't get carried away.
On a wonderful day.
And, of course, some people are going to be thinking, wonderful day, given the recent elections, particularly people, those who are kind of tied up in the, if only it were Clinton, everything would be wonderful or better or that sort of thing. You know, oh, we've lost the Supreme Court. You know, all the standard Democratic howls, the Democratic Party howls, that actually ignore the deteriorating situation as the wars ramp up. And the jobs fly overseas. Not that Trump is going to do diddly squat about any of this, but it's a miserable situation generally. That's the problem until the people rise up to change it. And the only thing that is hopeful around the Trump cataclysm is that people are finally seeing through and following and. Well, I was going to say they're seeing through the two-party system. They aren't. You say, why could that be? They're voting for the Republican. That's not really seeing through it. No, but they are, in essence, voting for someone that the entire establishment, Republican and Democratic, although the Republicans, you know, jumped on the board towards the end, hated. And, you know, there are plenty of good reasons to hate Trump, and there are good reasons as well. But the real reasons are is that he's a loose cannon for them. You know, he's not business as usual. And people don't want business as usual. And that's the hope, that people will, when they see Trump is business as usual or worse, that they can do that again in a more meaningful and constructive and or even destructive, but destructive of the right things kind of way. I'm going to turn now to some interviews. As regular listeners well know, there is a Freedom Sleep Out every Tuesday. That's an event that happens in front of City Hall on the sidewalk because they don't allow us to be at the seat of government. I mean, heavens forfend that you should sit with a placard saying end the sleeping ban or, I don't know, elect someone who will do something instead of these clowns who do nothing or, you know, change the whole system. You can't do that at night because somehow that's a public safety hazard. Of course, they've never made any finding that that's the case in a realistic way. And if there was anybody like the Coastal Commission did that would say this is an illegitimate action by the city council that was actually taken to crush a homeless protest, which it was back in 2010, essentially closing the area around City Hall, I think it would be really clear, and it actually did reach the court about 20 years ago in 1996 when then Mayor Mike Rodkin tried to shut down another homeless protest at City Hall, which had been there for 2 months, trying to get an injunction. And the judge wouldn't give him the injunction he wanted, which was to ban everybody at night. Instead, they snuck around and did this through a administrative decree by the Parks and Rec boss, who at that time was Danette Shoemaker. It happened, I think, about 2000. The law was passed in 2006, and it was... the actual decree was in 2010 when the Peace Camp 2010 folks were there. But in any case, every Tuesday night, sleepers gather, and they did this this last Tuesday. This is, however, some audio from Tuesday before last. That would be on November... Hang on a second. November 1st. Let's hear what them slumberers and wanderers, people are having a bite to eat from food provided by Joe Schultz and Food Not Bombs, and chatting and sitting for at least one evening, relatively free from police harassment, because when the police come to harass Food Not Bombs activist Abby Samuels pulls out her video camera. And if more people did this more regularly, I think we'd see a less harassment, frankly. Police get nervous when their actions are being documented. So let's hear a little of this.
Destroy the very top flyer.
Only the very top flyer.
Very good. Yep.
Freedom Sleep Out 69, Food Not Bombs table is still set up even as the evening dew destroys all the flyers on the table.
And only destroy the very top flyer.
Only the very top flyer.
Very good.
And we're talking with that man who is a top flyer man.
Keith McHenry.
A.K.A. Katzenjammer. A Katzenjammer, Keith, for all of you old-time comic strip readers from the 20s of German origin. So, Keith, you have been following a kind of a fan of the local Guardian Angels who've recently come to town?
Yeah, there was a meeting this weekend with Take Back Santa Cruz and the Guardian Angels to end criminalization, you know, the criminal element here in Santa Cruz. And one of
quite sure what's going on here. Don't go away yet. I think we got some more coming up here. Let's see. Not quite clear to me what the problem is. My apologies for all these.
Freedom Sleep Out 16.
Let's see if we can get ahead of this.
Santa Cruz and the Guardian Angels to end criminalization, you know, the criminal element here in Santa Cruz. And one of
So I'm having trouble with my own device here. My apologies, folks. I'm surprised because it was working earlier, and it may be that I have simply overloaded my poor machine. It needs to be given a respite. I'm not sure what the best thing to do is, but I'm going to see what I can do to give you some more of Keith McHenry, because he is informative and interesting, and I like him. I think you will, too. Let's see if I can... Yeah, I'm going to try to... We're going to eliminate a chunk here, and maybe we can actually proceed with hearing this uninterrupted. Let's see if we can. Let's see how we're doing here. I'm working on getting this together. Let's see if we're back on target here.
To end criminalization, you know, the criminal element here in Santa Cruz. And one...
But I apparently am... No. This machine has definitely got to go into the shop. Sorry. All right, well, while I madly improvise, let's hear another number from... The roar, the grease paint, the smell of the crowd.
It isn't enough to hope. It isn't enough to dream. It isn't enough to plot and plan and scheme. It isn't enough to stand here saying that life is grand here, waiting for something good to turn up. It isn't enough to sit here, having a purple fit here, worried to death the world will burn up. It isn't enough to hope. It isn't enough to dream. I've got a better answer. I've got a better scheme. Why not wish upon a wishbone, pick a four-leaf clover, rub a rabbit's foot, and throw a horseshoe over your lucky shoulder. You'll find before you're very much older, a bit of luck will come your way. Now isn't that enough to make your day? To hope. It isn't enough to dream. I've got a better answer. I've got a better scheme. Why not wish upon a wishbone, pick a four-leaf clover, rub a rabbit's foot, and throw a horseshoe over your lucky shoulder. You'll find before you're very much older, a bit of luck will come your way. Now isn't that enough to make your day?
It isn't enough from the Anthony Newley and Cyril Richard, actually Leslie Bricusse and Anthony Newley musical from the 60s. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. This is Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, the sinking show without all my audio, which is going to be pretty hard to deal with. But I was reading some interesting stuff, which may be able to sort of fill the gap, as long as my voice holds out. I'm going to go now to an article by Jack Rasmus called Why Trump Won and What's Next. This is on the Counterpunch website. U.S. real estate billionaire Donald Trump as president-elect. In an age when 97% of all GNP national income gains since 2010 have accrued to the wealthiest 1%, of which Trump is one, how could American voters come to elect Trump? How could they vote for a candidate that they simultaneously were giving a negative rating of 60 to 80%? That fundamental question will ever haunt this election. What the election shows is that American voters in electing Trump wanted anything but the above. Obama's policies of the previous 8 years, policies which were just extensions of the neoliberal regime established in the 1980s in the U.S. since Reagan. And voters didn't care about the political warts, past or present, of Trump. They just wanted something different. They wanted to stick their thumb in the eye of the ruling political elites of both parties. The voters' message was, you, the political elite, have hurt and harmed us these past 8 years. You have ignored us and left us behind while ensuring your wealthy friends recovered quickly and well from the 2009 crash. We have experienced great anxiety and insecurity. Now, have a taste of that yourself. Trump's campaign gifts, his personal character, his missteps and outrageous off-the-cuff statements, his lack of any government experience, only enhanced the view that he was not just another elite politician. His lack of TV ad spending, absence of a so-called ground game organization to turn out the vote, his having lost all three TV debates, according to the pundits and the press, his lack of field organization, and a poorly run Republican Party convention, all that was irrelevant. What his win, in spite of all that conventional political wisdom of what it takes to win an election, reflects is that the equation of politics is changing in the U.S. as the people, the masses, to use the jargon of prior times, are entering the political arena as a political force. And the fact is not just revealed in Trump's election. It was evident in Britain's recent Brexit referendum to leave the European Union. It will next be reflected in Italy's vote this coming December, in which political elite proposals for political reform to give them more power will also be rejected. It will reflect thereafter in the increasingly likely election of the far-right National Front in French elections next year, and could further reflect in German elections thereafter, in which that country's long-standing and presumably untouchable political leader, Angela Merkel, may also be overturned. Obama's vanished coalition. Trump's election could be traced to the shift in key groups of voters who had supported Obama in 2008 and who gave Obama his one more chance to do something in 2012 and who were deeply disappointed when he failed to do so since 2012. At the forefront of these groups was the white, non-college-educated working class, especially those concentrated in the Great Lakes industrial states, in that geographic arc from Pennsylvania to Wisconsin. This group not only turned from Democrats, but turned to Trump, as they had in 1980 as the so-called Reagan Democrats, in response to another economic crisis of the 1970s, during which they were also abandoned by the Democratic Party. Clinton 2016 thus lost the key swing states of Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Ohio, Iowa, and Michigan that helped put Obama over the top a second time in those states. Another important voter group that delivered for Obama in 2012 and did not for Clinton in 2016 in similar percentages were Latinos. They voted for a margin of 44% for Obama in 2012, but only 36% for Clinton. Apparently, Trump insults of Latinos were less important than Obama deportation policies in recent years. Women voters were supposed to vote overwhelmingly for Clinton, but white women aged 45 and over did not. And 75 million millennials, 34 and under, were driven away by Clinton and the Democratic Party's treatment of the Sanders campaign during which the primaries and by offering no solution to the hopeless scenario of insecure, low-pay service jobs in exchange for record student debt. In short, white, non-college-educated workers abandoned the Democrats, while other groups simply stayed home and did not vote in the numbers they previously had in 2012. Somehow, over recent years, the Democrats, once a party purporting to represent workers, abandoned them to free trade, to low-paid insecure service jobs, and to the wholesale privatization of retirement and health care systems in America. What was begun under Bill Clinton expanded under George W. Bush and was allowed to accelerate under Obama. Democrat leaders instead came to envision themselves as the corporate light party, agreeing to extending and expanding George Bush's tax cuts for the rich and their corporations, free money interest rates, and focusing instead on educated suburbanites as their prime voter base. The origins of Trump's victory, or it's still the economy, stupid. The root of the Trump victory lies in the history of the past 8 years and the deep failure of the Democratic Party and its now lame duck President Barack Obama to ensure that Main Street America recovered from the economic crisis of 2007 through 9, and not just the wealthiest 1% and their corporations. Hillary Clinton was not defeated so much by Trump, but by the failed performance of the Obama administration the past 8 years and her obvious inability to separate herself clearly from policies associated with the past 8 years and to offer an alternative more radically different, as Trump clearly did. We hear today from pundits and talking heads who just yesterday were declaring that Hillary Clinton was a shoo-in, that the election has been a reaction of the have-nots, i.e., those left behind. That's true. The Trump victory is clearly another expression of the global wave of working class and non-elite reaction against the political elite, their parties, and the so-called neoliberal policy establishment. But left behind what? The data shows clearly that U.S. profits more than doubled after 2009, U.S. corporate profits. The U.S. Dow stock market tripled in value. Bond market prices accelerated to record levels, and returns from derivatives and other forms of financial speculation, conveniently kept opaque from public scrutiny, no doubt surged to record levels as well. The record U.S. corporate profits alone were generously distributed to stock and bond stock shareholders. The 5% and especially 1% of the wealthiest U.S. households since 2010, more than $5 trillion has been distributed in stock dividend payouts and stock buybacks alone in the United States, and in the past 2 years at a rate of more than $1 trillion a year. Again, I have no idea what these figures mean, but perhaps all you knowledgeable stock marketeers out there do. And to ensure that the corporations and wealthiest 1% got to keep most of that distributed income, corporate and investor taxes under Obama since 2009 were cut by more than $6 trillion, extending the Bush tax cuts and then some. And all that's not counting other forms of capital incomes earned by the wealthiest 1%. Augmenting this historic massive profits gain and income redistribution favoring the 1% and corporate America, U.S. businesses have had access to trillions of dollars more in virtually free money made possible by the U.S. central bank's policies of quantitative easing and zero-bound interest rates. Don't ask me about those things, but look them up later and then educate me. In each of the last 3 years, corporations borrowed $2 trillion a year by issuing corporate bonds. They then hoarded the cash instead of investing and creating jobs. The zero rates also accelerated real estate property prices, benefiting the wealthiest. Since 2009, commercial real estate property has boomed in price, as has high-end residential housing. And what did the have-nots get since 2009? Stagnant wage gains, low-paid service jobs, often part-time, temp, contract, and gig, in exchange for the higher-paid jobs they lost, and tens of millions of young millennials with little hope of anything better for decades to come. The near-zero rates for 8 years engineered by the Federal Reserve, in turn, meant 50 million retirees, grandpa and grandma, earned no interest income whatsoever for the past 8 years and still don't. Meanwhile, more pensions collapsed and medical costs rose. The have-nots got to deal instead with 13 million home foreclosures and trillions of dollars of home values underwater, as they say, where the home value is less than the mortgage, and millions of homeowners still struggle with that. mortgage companies and banks were quickly bailed out by the Obama administration by 2010, but millions of small homeowners were left behind and still are. During the last 8 years, no bankers went to jail for their actions after 2009 and have steadily chipped away at any remnants of financial regulation. Big tech companies continue to hoard trillions of dollars of their cash overseas in subsidiaries to avoid paying taxes while bringing hundreds of thousands of skilled tech workers every year into the U.S., legal immigration, on H-1B and L-1 visas to take prime jobs that should have gone to U.S. workers. Big pharmaceutical companies continue to price gouge, causing thousands to die as a consequence of unaffordable prescription drugs. Millions of college students accrued more than $1 trillion in debt. Latino minorities were deported in record numbers, breaking up thousands of families. Police militarization and violence repressed African Americans in the inner cities. Unchecked fracking poisoned water supplies and air, and the country's infrastructure continued to rot from the inside out at an accelerating rate. After previous administrations failed to privatize health care in the U.S., Obama succeeded with the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare. At a cost of nearly $1 trillion a year, covering less than 15 million of the former 50 million uninsured, Obamacare redistributed income to provide subsidies to those covered. In exchange, the subsidized who bought Obamacare policies got super high deductible, low coverage health insurance. Health insurance companies, in turn, got tens of millions new customers guaranteed and paid for by taxpayers, and then continued to game the system for more profits. Obamacare became less a health care system reform act than a health insurance company subsidy act. It was the logical consequence of Obama's withdrawal of the public option and Democrats' refusal even to allow debate on extending Medicare for all. It will be repealed very shortly. Not least, the Obama administration championed an acceleration of free trade deals that promised to send even more jobs offshore after having pledged to oppose free trade when he was first elected. Bilateral trade deals were signed by him. TPP and TTIP Europe pushed, and the worst effects of NAFTA and CAFTA were ignored. Obama not only became the greatest deporter of immigrants in the U.S. history, as H-1B legal immigration was expanded by several hundreds of thousands. In foreign policy, the U.S. continued its constant wars in the Middle East that were never won or ended as Obama promised. Hillary herself was the prime instigator of the Libyan fiasco, a proponent of more direct military intervention in Syria, and probably supported the coup in Ukraine behind the scenes. All that did not win her votes, especially among millennials. American voters have become sick and tired of the incessant war policies of the administration. By not fundamentally breaking from this destructive economic and political legacy, the legacy of Obama and neoliberalism itself since 1980, Clinton all but ensured her fate and abandoned the field to Trump on the real issues. Trump didn't even have to offer specifics of what he'd do different. Just the impression that he somehow would reverse the policies quickly and in some way. What's next? The immediate consequences of Trump's election. Contrary to predictions of financial collapse, the Trump victory has already meant a big gain in stock markets as corporations and investors prepare for what they believe will be further big tax cuts quickly. After more than $10 trillion in business investor tax cuts since George W. Bush in 2003 to the present, trillions more are coming, and fast. The fate of the TPP is also now questionable, Trans-Pacific Partnership. Unless, of course, some way is arranged to push it through Congress rapidly in a lame duck session before Trump is sworn in as president in January, and provided he turns a blind eye to that, which is likely. The U.S. Supreme Court will now become even more conservative, and for decades to come, as Trump delivers on appointing 2-3 Antonin Scalia-like nominees to the court. It is unlikely the Democrats in the Senate can successfully oppose that until 2018. Racist elements of the grassroots will be greatly heartened by the Trump victory, as will militarized police forces. More clashes with immigrant and minority citizens on these issues will almost certainly grow in the period ahead. Obamacare will be repealed in toto in early 2017. Tens of millions will be left back where they were in 2008. Healthcare premiums and drug prices will surge still further. Dodd-Frank financial reform will also disappear, as weak as it was. Bankers will escalate their policies of financial speculation, creating more financial instability. Consumer financial protections will be rolled back. Environmental policies will be rolled back. The EPA will be gutted and reduced to a token, largely underfunded function of the government. Recent global climate deal in Paris will now unravel. Infrastructure spending by government will be on the table, passed by Republican Congress, in exchange for further massive corporate tax cuts. Infrastructure spending will be insufficient and will not significantly boost U.S. growth and jobs. An immigration bill will pass, but will prove harsh and harmful for immigrants from Latin America. H-1B and L-1 visas will expand, bringing more skilled foreign workers to the U.S. to take high-paying U.S. jobs. In foreign policy areas, NATO policies of the U.S. will shift. Europe will reconsider Russian sanctions. The recent Iran deal will get a new look. A U.S.-Russia deal on Syria will be explored. More Asian countries like the Philippines will consider closer ties to the U.S. To China as U.S. influence wanes in Asia. Of course, all the above shifts and changes are based on the assumption that Trump's campaign positions and promises will actually translate into domestic and foreign policy changes. That may not happen. It may have been all campaign rhetoric. Time will tell. Watch whether the U.S. political and economic elites in the immediate weeks again can successfully maneuver Trump into appointing their kind to the key policy implementation roles in a Trump administration, as they did with Obama and other neoliberal presidents before. My guess is that they will, for the real power in the U.S. politics lies with the elites behind the political parties and their formal political institutions. Trump made his billions by simply providing his name to properties and assets that he himself doesn't even own. We may soon see a political form of this celebrity economic strategy. U.S. neoliberal policy may not change fundamentally in a Trump regime, just its appearance. Neoliberalism formed under Reagan, Clinton, Bush imploded in 2007-2009. Obama has not been able to fundamentally restore it in its original form. A new form of neoliberalism will now be attempted to form, even more harsh than before. U.S. voters may come to realize that their rebellion against the political elite cannot be achieved through either wings of the single party of that elite, whether Republicans or Democrats. The rebellion will have to move outside the neoliberal political party structure. That may be the next political lesson to be learned. And that's an article by Jack Rasmus, who's the author of Systematic Fragility in the Global Economy. And it's Why Trump Won and What's Next on the Counterpunch website. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norse, and this is Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, the parsed-down edition, because, unfortunately, the interviews which I thought I had to play you do not seem playable on this machine. I'm going to have to consult with my techies and figure out what to do. Hopefully that'll be resolved by Sunday. And after all that rather dense economic blather, let's have another musical break.
If you want to grow up to be a gentleman, my child, you have a great deal to learn. There are so many things to remember as you travel the highway of life. Like always be kind to your husband, or if you're a man, to your wife. You must never shoot trout in September. You must never feed babies on gin. Don't ever play poker on Sundays unless you are certain to win. Ha ha! Don't go out of your way seeking danger. Never stand on a crocodile's tail. Never buy London Bridge from a stranger unless you can make a few bob on the sale. Don't waste time with the friends that repel you. And don't ever drink soup with a knife. Don't buy what those gypsy girls sell you. And if you remember these things that I tell you, by hell you'll do well all your life. When I think of the good things that life has to give, I'm reluctantly forced to agree that the number of people who know how to live is restricted, quite simply, to me. For life is like cricket, we play by the rules, but the secret which few people know, which keep men of class well apart from the fools, is to think up the rules as you go. There are so many things to remember when you study the fruit of the vine, and I am a hell of a student, and that's why I drink so much wine. Oh, I do beg your pardon. Drinking Cointreau with salt, beef and mustard is, of course, gastronomically wrong. And don't ever eat curry with custard. You'll find that it never stays down very long. Don't drink champagne from soggy old slippers, though this barbaric custom is rife. Don't lift up a whale by its flippers, and only buy claret from certified shippers. Avoid eating goulash with ice cream and kippers. Remember these things, you obnoxious young nippers, and you will do well all your life. So cheers, me dears, and here's to life.
And that was Remember These Things from The Roar of the Grease Paint, The Smell of the Crowd. So, phone number here, 427-3772. The real issue for me is what is to be done next in Santa Cruz locally around the issues that concern me specifically. Restoring civil rights for people outside and dealing with entrenched police militarism, institutionalized and somewhat sort of fossilized violence or the threat of violence as most recently epitomized by the killing of Sean Ault, or Arlt, I'm not quite sure what the pronunciation is. You know, the man who had a rake at 3 in the morning and was shot dead 20 seconds after the police arrived, or after he was confronted with the rake, and with the police refusal to release the audios and the videos, and even the name of the person who shot Sean. And we had a protest today about that, a very small one at the corner of Laurel and Center, Cop Corner is what I call it, because it's where the police station is, right across from the Loudon Nelson Center. And we had actually, surprisingly enough, a Sentinel reporter and a photographer there who were scribbling away and taking photos of our ragtags table and signs, and only a handful of protesters. One of the main organizers was sick. That's Steve Argue. He's a regular broadcaster here on Santa Cruz's free radio. But hopefully he'll be feeling better on Saturday, which is when he would be doing his normal show. But in any case, the Sentinel asked me, Sentinel reporter Ryan, and damned Ryan, if I can remember your last name. And I have the Sentinel here. Maybe there's a story with your name on it. There probably is, because you're a regular contributor to this particular fish wrap. or the scent anal, as I like to call it. There's Kara Guzman. There's Jessica York, my old favorite. Here we go. Ryan Masters. That's his name. Yeah, nice guy. You know, he's... But the only question he said he wanted to play devil's advocate in the Sean Arlt issue about, you know, why we're here to demand the police release the audio and the video they took of the shooting and let us know who did the shooting. And his response was, well, why do you need that at all? I mean, you know, they say they need it for the investigation. Why don't you wait until the investigation is over, which is what the police department is insisting we do, and what the city council is refusing to take any action to undo or to speed up, in spite of a big showing of people at city council. And my question back to him was, why? Why should we wait for that? What possible justification is there for the police to withhold this? I mean, I could use a sort of a more conspiratorial perspective and say, unless the police show us the data at an early stage, there are a couple of things that happen. Public interest tends to abate. The possibility of the data being corrupted or manipulated or maneuvered becomes greater. Then there's also a kind of authority given to the police department that I don't think should be there. I mean, this was a killing of a person who many feel, myself included, was unnecessary. That the police department's claim of officer safety was spurious. It was sort of routinized. It was a kind of a knee-jerk, instinctive, but no less toxic and lethal and unforgivable kind of behavior that there's no indication is going to be any different in future encounters. And people will say, well, wait, no, these are good guys. You know, they're a couple of bad apples. They may need some retraining. And I've often said, that's not it at all. Good people put into uniforms with guns and badges and told to follow certain policies become, in essence, Nazi stormtroopers. They become bad guys. They become captive of the uniforms and the organization they are in. Whether you're talking about Democratic Party hacks, or, you know, Ku Klux Klan members, or police officers, or, you know, I don't know, members of any particular group that imposes a standard upon those people, particularly when their livelihood depends on it, and particularly when there's all kinds of powerful social support, in part because the police department is the class warrior. That is to say, the warrior for the upper class that holds the society in place. That is the reason that I don't know if we'd say it's the reason the poor don't eat the rich, to use a sort of an old metaphor, or raid the shops, get the food they need, et cetera, et cetera. Essentially riot or demand their share of the gross national income or gross national product or the increase in productivity that you may remember from the article I was reading you a few minutes ago is essentially going into the pockets of the wealthy 1% that doesn't need them at all, but that it simply expands its power that way. I mean, so the police department acts to protect essentially the well-to-do rather than those who aren't. And it's not that that's part of the law, but that just seems to be part of the practice. And in order to do that, one of the ways of doing that is to increase the terror, ramp up the fear, get people to follow orders unthinkingly when they're issued by people in uniforms, particularly with badges and guns. And we didn't hear or see the killing of Sean Arlt. But in other cases, in other police departments and other places, it seems to be the refusal to follow orders that results in the use of excessive force, even lethal force. Not the actual circumstance demanding that, but because the police department somehow feels that if you don't treat them as the big daddy that they conceive themselves to be, and that they are perhaps funded to be and authorized to be in some kind of sick way, they have the right to beat you down or shoot you down. And indeed, this is sort of incorporated in a California law, which says something to the effect, and this is at least what I was told 20 years ago when it came up, and there was a discussion between the public defender and the prosecutor before the now-gone Citizens Police Review Board, about is it legal to resist arrest if the arrest is unlawful? Is it legal to use force to resist an arrest? And a jury recently in Oregon, in the case of those right-wing folks who grabbed a piece of property and in protest to I think some federal land regulation, to the chagrin of the Native Americans who didn't like that either. But the point was the jury found the entire group not guilty, even though they were probably technically guilty of all kinds of violations. But the issue is, are they following the orders? And are the orders reasonable? Becomes the question. And why do there need to be orders? We see this most obviously, like in downtown Santa Cruz, where police show up in massive numbers. If somebody is, as for example, Alex Skelton and Joff Jones were outside one of their little blue marking brass disc boxes set up by the Matthews regime, the Matthews government, the city council led by Cynthia Matthews, to restrict box in and essentially it's just to discourage, though I'm sure they would claim that it's to organize and make neat and civilize and assist, but it's actually its impact is to make if the law is enforced, and it can be at any time, often it's not. Police actually do have better things to do, and it does cause a lot of resentment when it's enforced. But the issue is really following the orders of, in this case, the city council. But it can be when the police department orders you to do something in aid of that law or any of these other trivial laws with a massive number of cops around, they maintain their authority by getting you to do so through fear. And that was one of the things our protest was actually working on addressing. We have a call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, Robert, Merlin.
Hey, Merlin. You are, of course, another one of our prime broadcasters. Your show is Tuesday night, is that right?
Yeah, Tuesday night, 7 p.m., Idleland Show. It's going to be with Dolly, Dolly and Hans, and Merlin. Yeah.
And you're a man who plays, different?
It's rock and roll, and old school, and comedy to describe the show. But when I, if I burn a CD of my show and I come home and listen to it, this is going to sound weird. But it seems to me like some sort of a musical, spiritual journey. That's not my making,
And so that'll be coming up next Tuesday at 9 o'clock?
7 p.m.
7 p.m., sorry.
Yeah, I can't hear your show because I'm in Capitola now, Robert, so I apologize if I'm calling in an inopportune time. I've tried to tune it in, but it just won't come in. It used to.
Yeah, well, we have won't be coming in tomorrow. After tomorrow at all, as you know, because our transmitter and our antenna are coming down. But you have to get yourself a computer, buddy.
Yeah, I know.
But, I know that I spoke to you before this, and you were talking about the real problems you were having the odyssey you had to go through to get pain medications prescribed by a physician for a medical condition you have. It sounded like, kind of so outrageous that I wanted you to call in and talk about it.
Man, and it's just not today going through to get my medicine. It's like I've been on this for years, and years ago I was on 1,000 times more. And so, over the years, the good doctors weaned me off, and I wanted to also, right? So now we get down to where I'm right next to almost off the stuff, but I'm not yet.
Let me interrupt you, Merlin, and ask, what's your condition and what's the medication?
Well, I have a bad back. They just took an MRI for the second time in my life, and they're giving me morphine, like, you know, 10 milligram or twice a day or something like that, or four, you know, like something like that. I haven't even got the prescription. I just dropped it off at the pharmacy. Finally found a pharmacy that would accept it. I mean, they're telling me, I went to a pain specialist, and this guy's first words are, I don't really like, you know, prescribe pain medicine for people that are in pain. You know, first things out of my mouth are, what the fuck good are you? You know, because I was just, at that point, so frustrated with the whole runaround. I mean, everybody wants to say, oh, pain meds are bad, people are ODing and selling them and all that stuff. Well, there's some people out here like us that don't want to get a back operation. I just had my hip operated on last year, and my hip surgeon said, you know, I'm not going to use my real name, but he says, Merlin, I will never get my back operated on by a surgeon because I don't have faith in them, that they know what they're doing. And I go, you know, I felt like that, personally feel like that, but you kind of, like, justify it for me by mentioning that, being a surgeon. And when I talked to my back surgeon the first time I had this condition, he was really honest with me. You know, it was Dr. Shibetta. He was very honest. And he said, look, I could do a 100% successful operation on your back, and you could be in twice as much pain the rest of your life. It's a roll of the dice. Everybody's nerves are different down there. Some don't react well towards scalpels. And you know what? I don't want to throw those dice, Robert. So, you know, the only option I understand I have is pain meds. And I'm weaning myself down to almost nothing from, you know, a whole enough to kill a horse about 4 to 10 years ago. And I'm getting down so frustrated because when I go to pharmacies, they treat me like dirt sometimes. You know, as soon as they find out what I want, it's like, you know, we don't have that. Or, you know, I mean, I get a million excuses. We're not going to get that till Wednesday. And then they say, they don't make that milligram when I have the damn things at home. And I know they make them. You know, I'm going to get every excuse in the book not to get service. The only ones that seem to be the helpful is Safeway. They seem to, you know, have a heart. And then I also have the stupid thing of, with my insurance company, they'll only allow you to have, like, 60 pills of one kind, like my morphine. I can only have 60 of them in 1 month, you know. So, but, you know, with the kind of milligram I'm taking right now, you know, like 25 or 10 or 15, it's like, it's so inconvenient. You know, they don't have their shit together. You know, they want everybody to come off this stuff, but they certainly fuck don't help us to do it. They make it a stumbling block.
Well, tell me about your journey today, and name the places you went to and what happened.
I went to CVS, I can't go to CVS on 41st Avenue because I went there last month, and the pharmacist told me when I handed her my prescription that she filled, by the way, a couple days later, but she told me, I'm not going to fill any more prescriptions for pain meds for you unless they come from a pain specialist. And I told her, well, my experience is with the pain specialist. I'm not welcome there anymore, and I wouldn't go back even if I was. And so, you know, why are you telling me this? I'm asking her. It's my obligation to tell you this. You know, I've never heard this in my life from a pharmacist. And then later on, Dolly, my co-host, looks it up on the internet and finds out there's a bunch of complaints against CVS for the same type of thing. You know, it's like I'm going there to get the pain meds, not get harassed.
So is this a recent thing? I mean, how long have you been taking morphine?
Oh, even 10 years. And now I'm almost off the stuff. And I'm really getting harassed by all the pharmacies.
So what was this the case 10 years ago?
What do you mean?
Did you get the same kind of treatment then?
PC thing was different, you know. Then they were over-prescribing. That's why I was on a boatload of drugs. I was over-prescribed. But the same doctor that over-prescribed me, you know, weaned me off most of it, was a good doctor. And I appreciate that doctor. I have nothing against the doctors. It's not the doctors I got to beef. It's the pharmacies. And I don't know, it's somebody at the insurance companies, I guess. They just make it so it's almost impossible for a person to follow their plan and we can get off the drugs. Okay, but don't make me jump through hoops and make it. I got to go to 10 different pharmacies to get my damn drugs.
Well, tell me more about what happened after you went to CVS on 44.
Well, I got my, well, you know, that was last month. But anyway, so I didn't go to that one on 41st Avenue today. I skipped it because I feel like, well, they're not going to fill it because it's not from a pain specialist anyway. So it's a waste of time. So the first place I went for my doctor was Safeway on 41st said, we got to order the stuff, but we can get it for you. And I said, okay, well, give me the prescription back. And they suggested a couple of other places to go, right? So I thanked them and went on my merry way on my bike. And I got my doctor's in Aptos. So, you know, I'm on 41st Avenue now. So now I'm riding down 41st Avenue to some other place where it's a compounding place by McDonald's. And they just said they don't have this stuff. And I'll say, okay, thanks very much. And so I go over to across the street by the IHOP. There's a Lucky's, and then there's, some kind of drugstore there. And they said they don't have this stuff. So I'm like, you know, what the fuck kind of prescription is this? I mean, it's pretty low on the milligrams. It's not like I'm asking for a whole bunch of stuff. And, you know, someone said, well, where do I go? And they suggested maybe go over to, go here or go there, all the way across town, you know, by, like, Costco or something, or Walgreens. And it's like, at this point, I'm already spending 3.5 hours trying to ride my bike around and get the stupid prescription. So anyway, I come back, call my doctor, tell him what's happening. They say, please come back and we'll help you. And they did. The doctor's nurse found, after hour, the doctor was an hour on the phone, and he told me that the pharmacist misquote. They told him that, oh, we don't make those drugs, when he knows darn well they do, because I have them. And he goes, I don't know what's going on with everybody at the pharmacies, but it seems confusing. I go, yeah, I imagine if you're in my boat, you need the damn things. You know, that's why I went off the shit, because it's, you know, obviously addicting. But, you know, thank God I'm so low on it right now. But it's just, the whole experience, Robert, is just so, you're like demoralized. You feel like you're a junkie. And they look at you and talk to you. Some of the people are nice, but some of the pharmacists look at you and talk to you like, you know, like you said, fuck your mom or something to them before you walked in. They just got an attitude as soon as they find out what drug it is you want. And I'm like, hey, lady, I really have a fucked up back.
What's
they want to operate on it.
Merlin, what's the name of the drug that you were talking about?
Morphine.
It's just, I mean, is there a generic name or a brand name?
Morphine sulfate.
Morphine sulfate.
And it's like, you know, I'm down to like, I don't know, 40 or something.
And so how many places did you have to go before you finally got this prescription?
Today, like five.
Had to go to five.
Yeah, and finally Safeway and Aptos was kind and considerate and generous and said, we'll fill it for you today or tomorrow. You know, none of this, we can't fill it because the insurance company won't pay. So if the insurance company won't pay, how the hell is it Safeway can fill it? You know, that's just what I'm telling you. That just proves to me that all the other pharmacies are running me around. Basically, they want to make it so hard and a hassle for me, but now, I just don't want to. That won't go.
Now, Merlin, has this a sort of a monthly thing you have to do, or is that?
Oh God, yes, man! This is going on for 10 years every month.
So last month, what kind of a treatment did you get?
That's what I told you last month. The CVS pharmacy on 41st Avenue. The pharmacist told me I'm not going to fill anything for you unless it's from a pain specialist.
But did you get? You didn't get it filled last month, then?
Yeah, she did. You know, after she told me she'll never fill it unless it's from a pain specialist, two days later she filled it.
And the month before that?
The month before that wasn't that bad. You know, but I mean, this is off and on kind of a thing. All the pharmacists act like, oh my God, he's got, you know.
Now, do you think this is sort of, you know, as I say, kind of back and forth, on and off, or is there a trend developing that's looking progressively?
Well, it's overdeveloped, man. It's not developing. It's well-developed. Everybody, you know, like if you're on pain pills, they seem to, people that haven't ever experienced chronic pain, you know, they tell people, and also you hear many stories from people that were on pain pills. Oh, yeah, I was on a ton of pain pills, and I didn't need them, so I got off. Well, I need the damn things, not a ton of them. But, you know, I do need them because I don't want to get an operation. And,
I think what you might want to do is document the names of the pharmacists who are refusing you treatment.
I know I do. I just don't want to mention them over the air.
Why not?
I'm just mentioning the ones who are nice to me.
Why don't you mention the ones that aren't? That's what interests me.
Well, the ones that weren't were CVS on 41st Avenue.
And the name of the pharmacist?
I can't even take a pain med there anymore unless it's from a specialist.
Name of the pharmacist?
I don't know. I asked her name because I got to wear reading glasses, right? She had her name tag on, but it was blurred to me. And I said, what's your name? It doesn't matter. No, it does to me. What is your name? And it doesn't matter. Do you want your drugs on Friday? So she's got me by the balls. Of course I shut the hell up and say, yes, I want my drugs on Friday.
Well, I mean, I hear you. But you can also say, good, give me your superior if you're not going to give me your name.
She was, said she was the owner and pharmacist of the place.
Okay,
the
well, then
and you, the whole big dog.
If that's the case, then you get the name of the pharmacy. See, I think there may be a disability discrimination happening here, although I'm
well,
not...
Oh, yeah, Dolly looked it up on the Internet, and there's many complaints against...
And what I'm saying,
yeah.
I'm not talking about complaints. I'm talking about, presumably, at some level... your right to get some sort of, you know, legal assistance on this. But I don't know. I'm kind of swimming in deep water here. Or...
I'm not really trying to pursue it legally. I just want, like Dolly said, there is a complaint I can file and hand it to the pharmacist and hand it to the store owner and then file it with the headquarters. And I want to do that, and I keep asking her, please download that stuff. I want to put my name on that complaint list, too. But that's all I want to do. Is just, and I'm happy to be able to have an opportunity to say it on the air, on the radio.
Yeah, I mean, see, I think that, see, if you also know what your rights are in terms of this.
Hell no.
No, you don't need to be a lawyer to know what your rights are, but it takes a little research to find out.
Yeah, I'm disabled.
I don't know, you know, if you're disabled and you have a right, you know, and you have a bona fide medical condition and they're denying you medication that is legitimately prescribed by your pharmacist.
Doctor,
the issue. And again, I'm talking through my ass here, but the issue then might well be that it's not so much you want to, you know, go to court and all that shit.
No, I'm not trying to.
Wait a minute, Merlin. It's not that you wouldn't want to, you know, go through that whole process, but if you can come in the next time to any pharmacist, you wouldn't say, look, this is the law. I got a copy of it with me. Are you going to, you know, fulfill my prescription or not? Okay, you know, that can be, and if you're not, give me your name and give me.
Yeah, why are you kicking me out of here then? Or why are you not serving me?
You don't even have to get into that. All you have to do is say, this is the law. Are you going to follow it or not? Okay, if you're not, give me your name.
Well, one of the things
and
I can
also,
say that
and
I've
also,
done
wait a minute, Merlin.
Example.
Hang on, Merlin.
What?
And if they do, and it also is helpful to have an audio machine with you to record their responses.
Yeah, like
say, look. Well, it's not that hard to, you know, get a cheap machine.
That's right.
You know, and so, anyway, so, and I interrupted you. Go ahead. Finish what you wanted to say, and I'm going to roll out of here. Go ahead.
It's spaced out.
Oh, well, you need your meds there.
Need my meds. No, I just spaced out on the air, too, you know. It's just
well, listen, thanks for giving me the update. Again, as I would like to see...
yeah, I'm not, like, grudging against these people. I
would like to see you be able to, you know... not just you, but anybody in your situation.
Oh, wait a minute. I remember what I was going to say, bro. Listen, it was along the same lines you were talking. Like, you have to wait, from what I understand, the law says the pharmacy, the insurance companies won't pay for the next month's prescription unless 28 days have passed. And all these pharmacies today were telling me, you know, and according to the doctor, he said today was the 28th day, right?
Okay, look, I can't go into the details with this.
Merlin,
there's no point in talking about this because I don't know the details. I don't know the law, and I don't know whether what the pharmacist is telling you is accurate or inaccurate or partially accurate. But I think, you know, you have to find out. what your rights are, because if you're being screwed over, you have no other alternative but to find that out or to continue to get screwed over. That's the problem. And even, even if you find out what your rights are, you may still continue to get screwed over. However, we can always talk about it on the radio.
Where can I get this information?
Well, it's a very good question. I suppose... you know, there are disability organizations, probably not in Santa Cruz, but I'm thinking like in San Jose and San Francisco. And I think if you call me after the show, I may be able to, you know, point you in this direction or that. I think there's some local people.
I could see you at the, you know, at the next meeting.
Yeah, or you can call me. Better to catch me at home because I probably don't have the information with me at a meeting, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I appreciate your calling in. I'm going to roll you off so I can... you know,
yeah, how's the show going?
Play a little. It's horrible because my audio machine is not working, and so I can't play the real voices from the street that need to be heard. And
I noticed occasionally when I was, you know, I use all the different equipment in there, right, at the same time.
Yeah, it's not this equipment. It's my equipment. It's my machine. I'll talk to you later.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye. Phone lines are open, 427-3772. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, for the last day until we find a site to put up our antenna and to locate our transmitter. We will be streaming starting tomorrow, well, continuing tomorrow. We're streaming now, but we will not be broadcasting until we can find a place. And please let us know if you have any thoughts or ideas. It's any place in the Santa Cruz area we're looking for. Call me at 423-4833. That's not the studio number, 423-4833. That's my home phone. And you can leave a message there, and I can then get back to you, and you can, or just leave the tip. Oh, you can try this place down the road and blah, blah, blah. And you can let us know what you think might be a place for us to go and ask, or you might have some friends who are maybe would actually want to host the radio station's transmitter. And we can let you know if there are risks involved, which there the risks mainly are pressure from the FCC. No one who's ever hosted a free radio antenna, and there's been at least a dozen folks who've done that, has ever been prosecuted by the feds. So they usually they'll pressure the landlord to tell you to stop it, and then we have to move somewhere else. But for a period of time, we're able to be there, and I haven't heard of landlords coming down on any of the people that did this. It's possible it's happened, but I have not heard that was the case. So once more, a quick descent into music land. And again, to remind you to call the station, the number here is 427-3772. 427-3772.
The law of the grease paint, the smell of the...
No, 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 with all due respect, sir, I'd like to say a word or three about the way you're treating me in front of everyone. You say I lay about and shirk, you must take me for such a jerk, cos I do all the bleeding work while you have all the fun. Far be it from me, sir, to dare to carp or criticise. I just want you to realise I don't do this for exercise. I just want you to see, sir, how wicked and unfair it is. I don't know why, but there it is. It's more than I can bear, and frankly I object. That is, with due respect. Forgive my presumption. I know that you're a gentleman, a slightly temperamental man, a man of intellect. But I suspect that your neglect is largely why my health is wrecked. No ifs or buts, I hate your guts, with all due respect. To be rude, sir, but everything I do is wrong. You make me feel I don't belong because I dropped off in your song. Please give me some food, sir. A bit of bread and cheese will do, or maybe just a crust or two, but something I can chew. He feeds me once a week. I'm much too weak to speak. To say, sir, I've had about enough of it. I always get the rough of it, so what can you expect? You must detect the bad effect you've had upon my self-respect. A bleeding shame, but who's to blame, with all due respect? My mind you have mastered. You sit there half plastered. You aren't half a fuckhead. With all due respect, with all due respect.
And, of course, that was With All Due Respect. So, again, 427-3772, if you'd like to call in. I think I may have a few quick announcements here. Indie Bay has been doing some interesting stuff. There actually was also an Indie Bay photographer at the Cop Corner show us the video, show us the audio, give us the names of the officers, and also make changes in police department policies locally that we were urging this afternoon with holding up signs, giving out literature. And I was surprised, pleasantly surprised, at the number of cars that rolled down their windows and wanted to read what we had to say. It was a relatively short message, and we announced another rally a week from today. at Cop Corner. We may move that to the town clock, which is a somewhat more active location, yet both for people who are walking by and for cars. And we may move it to a weekend because that will allow other people to participate. And there just did seem to be a significant number of people concerned about this issue. I'm sorry also we didn't actually take this to the Cynthia Matthews Pious Veterans Day celebration at the City Hall, which wasn't really, if it was announced, I missed it. I have today's paper, and I don't think it was, maybe it was buried in a news story somewhere. There's going to be closures tomorrow in observation of Veterans Day. County offices will be closed. City offices will be closed in both the county, Santa Cruz, Capitola, Scotts Valley, Watsonville. Libraries are all going to be closed tomorrow. Post offices are going to be closed. Santa Cruz Metro, the local bus service is going to be on a weekend schedule for all you folks who have to use the buses. It's a little unclear who the final winners are in the Santa Cruz City Council race. As of about a day ago in today's paper, Cynthia Matthews got 14% of the vote. There were four seats open and 10 people running. The top four were Cynthia Matthews, Martine Watkins, Chris Crone, and Robert Singleton. But closely pursuing were J.M. Brown, Sandy Brown, and Drew Glover. And there are numerous votes yet to come in. And I think I'm looking for the exact number. There's quite a number of votes that have not been counted. To date, there are 82,000-plus ballots that were counted. 48% of these were mail ballots, but there are another 14,000 or so mail ballots returned to the polls on Election Day, so there's quite a number of them. And it could change, but right now only one of the Santa Cruz, the brand-new council quartet of Sandy Brown, Steve Schnarr, Chris Crone, and Drew Glover got in, and that was Crone, who I've talked about a bit on the air. Haven't interviewed him, and we'll see if he wants to be interviewed. He's he tends to avoid substantive issues, I've found, when I've talked to him in the past. But, well, you know, you never can tell. Times can change, I guess. There are a couple of other updates that I think might interest regular listeners, particularly folks concerned with civil rights for homeless folks. The LA City Council has banned sleeping in vehicles near homes and schools. It's a particularly pernicious kind of law, just on its face. I don't know. I haven't read it. When I hear that, the notion that somehow it is a danger to have somebody sleeping in a vehicle near a school or a home implies that those who are sleeping in vehicles are somehow more dangerous than those who are sleeping in houses, which is a way of criminalizing homeless people, stigmatizing homeless people, demonizing unhoused people whose vehicle is their, who have no choices to go to. And Los Angeles, that's been established in a court case called the Jones case 10 years ago. And they had to actually end the sitting ban and the sleeping ban on the street because they don't have shelters for people. That would, for the tens of thousands of homeless who are there. Anyway, here's this story. LA City Council banned sleeping in vehicles near homes and schools. Gary Mann, a sign painter, lives in his camper in Venice. The LA City Council has adopted a new overnight ban on occupying and sleeping in cars, vans, and campers in residential areas. A day after voters handed Los Angeles $1.2 billion to build supportive housing, the City Council on Wednesday adopted a nighttime ban on living in vehicles near homes, parks, and schools over objections from advocates who contend the measure will criminalize thousands of homeless people. A 1983 measure prohibiting vehicle dwellings citywide had been a key enforcement tool as the city sought to control growing homelessness. That's it. By controlling growing homelessness, they mean driving homeless people out. That's what they mean. This is the sort of genteel way of putting that. That law was struck down 2 years ago by the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, which held that it was an invitation to discriminate against homeless people. Dare I say, duh. Council members said the new city ban legalizes living overnight in vehicles for the first time by permitting parking and sleeping in industrial or commercial districts from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. The ordinance cites unsanitary conditions, noise, and crime in support of the ban. So it's okay to have unsanitary conditions, noise, and crime in industrial and commercial districts. Los Angeles City Council? And says vehicle dwelling, quote, diminishes the economic viability of the city. Who wants to buy upper-class houses if somebody's going to be sleeping nearby in their van? And its many tourist attractions. There are hundreds of thousands of people who are concerned people have turned their curbs into an apartment. Councilman Marquise Harris Dawson, who represents part of South Los Angeles, said during the council's brief public hearing, that's just not fair to anybody. Westside Councilman Mike Bonin said half the city's streets will be open for overnight parking, but advocates objected that block-by-block regulations adopted in the wake of the court decision severely limit homeless people's options. They're probably talking about things like Santa Cruz's permit parking signs, which prohibit you not from sleeping, which violates the Desert Train decision by the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals 2 years ago. I could be wrong about that being the Desert Train. There could have been another one. But apparently, according to the story, there was a decision 2 years ago that you can't ban people from. And this 1983 law is out because it invites discrimination against homeless people, obviously. That's what it was meant for. Instead of banning sleeping, they're banning parking. That's what they tried to do with RVs in Santa Cruz City and County that was thrown out or at least stalled by the Coastal Commission. And I reported on that earlier in the show. In Los Angeles, and I don't know, it's not clear to me yet, but they're likely to be doing the same thing, I would think. That is to say, we aren't banning sleeping. We just aren't going to let you park here. So that also bans sleeping because you obviously can't sleep if you can't park there. I guess people could, in protest, this might be a good idea, say, well, we aren't going to park there. We'll just unload all our sleeping bags and we'll unload ourselves, set up a little tent on the sidewalk and sleep there because you won't let us park our vehicle here. And you can't arrest us because sleeping at night is not a crime in Los Angeles, provided you're 10 feet from a business and provided a certain number of housing units have not been built. That was the Jones settlement back in 2006. But I don't know. They maybe have found some way around that with this new law, or maybe not. We'll see. I'll have to chat with, maybe we'll have a chat with Peggy Lee Kennedy down there and see what she has to say. Or Calvin, regular listeners to this show who call in and give us updates from Southern California. The new law, according to Westside Councilman Mike Bonin, according to advocates in Los Angeles, the new law will banish working mothers with children to isolated and dangerous corners of the city far from work or school, they said. There are a lot of working families that live in their cars. Venice resident Mike Chamness testified during the hearing. There is nowhere in Venice where you can park your car and sleep in your vehicle. And Venice, of course, is a suburb of Los Angeles on the ocean. And we've gotten some updates from Peggy Lee Kennedy, who has been fighting for the rights of Venice performers, artists, and homeless folks who are being regularly attacked by neighborhood conservatives and police department and so forth. Bonin, the right-wing council member, said a plan to develop parking lots where homeless people can sleep was making its way through the city approval process, but speakers assailed officials for pushing enforcement before the alternatives are in place. Mayor Eric Garcetti's spokeswoman did not immediately respond when asked whether he would sign the measure into law. Voters on Tuesday overwhelmingly approved a $1.2 billion bond measure designed to fund construction of 10,000 apartment units over 10 years for medically vulnerable homeless people living in the streets for a year or more. The old law had prohibited people from using a vehicle parked on a city street or in a municipal or county parking lot as, quote, living quarters, both overnight and day-by-day or otherwise. The Ninth Circuit said the law failed to define living quarters or specify what otherwise meant. The court's ruling also said the city's ban had resulted in arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement. It appears to be applied only to the homeless, Judge Harry Pregerson wrote in the decision. Civil rights lawyers asserted Wednesday that the new law's definition of dwelling, which includes possessing a blanket or bedroll or preparing a meal, could apply to any driver stopping to rest or eat on the road. I have some of these items in my car I keep for emergencies, said Carol Sobel, who brought the lawsuit that overturned the old law. I think it was the Desert Train decision. If it's only used against homeless people, the new law would also be discriminatory, said the attorneys who raised the prospect of another lawsuit. Lawyer Gregory Bonnet of Public Counsel, a public interest legal group, faulted the council for adopting the ban on a day's notice at a special meeting barely 24 hours after a high-stakes election. And I also heard that it was also, there was some slimy business done, according to Peggy Lee Kennedy in an email she sent me, in terms of not informing the public that it was even coming up on the agenda. Lawyers also objected to subjecting homeless people to criminal infractions and $25 fines instead of administrative penalties. They said the law could put homeless people in peculiar circumstances of having to get out of their vehicles to sleep on sidewalks, which is what I was suggesting, which is permitted under a court settlement. And interestingly enough, this was proposed by a council member here in Santa Cruz when Christopher Crone was in office back around the turn of the millennium. I think it was in 1999. Councilmember Tim Fitzmaurice, also a mayor at one point, too, and the man who prompted my arrest in the mock Nazi salute case, even though the arrest itself was done by Chris Crone, proposed that it be legal for a person to sleep on the sidewalk without blankets. I kid you not. This was when the city council was under extreme pressure from many people in the community to end the sleeping ban and to establish safe sleeping zones. He instead proposed a series of, I don't even want to call them token alternatives. They were bizarre kind of piecemeal suggestions. One was his proposal currently in law called three nights per month and then out of town, which essentially is part of the law now, which says you're allowed to park your vehicle in someone else's driveway with their permission and the permission of the owner, I guess to be written, but only for three nights for any month. So you get for three nights in a month, you get to sleep, but for the other 27, it's illegal for you to do that. We have a really ridiculous sleeping ban law that is still in place and that is again the subject of protest every Tuesday night at City Hall by people who blatantly and openly defy it on the sidewalk, and the police ignore this, but then they go around and enforce it the rest of the week against folks. And they're also using the so-called closed areas law, which is a law, another arbitrary law used specifically to essentially go after homeless people wherever they try to find a place to rest their heads. Suddenly that becomes a closed area at night, even though it hadn't been before. Not because any damage was done to the property, but just to drive them away. And this kind of thing is obviously wrong. And so the question is, how can we who feel pissed enough to do something about it take new action to end it? That's what Huff does. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. We debate, brood, fling insults at each other and try to figure out what to do at our Wednesday meeting. And some of these things involve, for example, the protests that we did today, which is at the police station, or on the corner next to the police station. It tails on the Sean Arlt shooting by the police. But there are many other things, and really probably more fundamentally relevant things to homeless people that are happening every night that the police department is responsible for, most notably seizure and destruction of homeless property, not just the police department, the Parks and Rec department, private security guards, and then just the abasement of homeless people, the humiliation of homeless people, the demand that they follow these orders to move along, the treatment of homeless people as, I don't want to say dogs. Dogs are treated much better than homeless people. The dogs, you know, are beloved pets. The amount of resources that Santa Cruz County puts into dogs dwarfs the amount of resources put into shelter for homeless people. There is no shelter for the overwhelming majority of homeless people this winter coming up. Right now, there's no shelter, period, unless you happen to be in a program. And I've talked about this at length in the past, how the Homeless Lack of Services Center has devolved into essentially almost a overt poverty pimp situation where homeless people only serve the purposes of this shelter if they can bring in federal funds. That it's not a place for people to go because they need a place to sleep. It's rather they have to have a pathway to housing, be part of this mythology that homeless people you see are outside because they are bums, they are idle, or they are mentally ill and need to be locked up or medicated forcibly or persuaded to take mental health treatment. This is coming up soon at the city council, I should say, at the Board of Supervisors, in the Laura's Law situation, where I haven't really talked about this much recently. Maybe I'll talk about it more on Sunday. Laura's Law is a state law that allows much easier forced medication and incarceration of homeless people. And, you know, you keep hearing this oft-repeated chant, oh, she went off her meds. Oh, you know, the medication is going to help them. They have to be forced to take their medication. It's not, in many, if not most cases, true that medication in the long terms, according to studies done by the World Health Organization, actually improve outcomes for mental health problems. That doesn't mean there aren't things that do, kindness, rest, decent places to be, recognizing that life crises are things that have to be worked through. I haven't got any magic bullets here, pardon the metaphor. But the notion that somehow you can dope people into sanity is a false analogy, which is derived from the finding that some medications are magic bullets for some physical ailments, you know, like polio or, you know, penicillin. And this is something that I understand it. Even psychiatry has admitted, but that pharmaceutical companies don't like brooded about that because their livelihood is dependent upon the mythology that pills cure mental illness or control it in ways that result in more beneficial outcomes than not doing so. Anyway, I'm going to have to take my show on the road shortly because we're going to have a special version of Uncle Dennis's show, From the Cream to the Dregs. Uncle Dennis is currently not available, but devoted followers of his are here to take his place. That's going to happen from 8 to 11 or sometime in that period, at least starting at 8. I really apologize for not having, I don't know if I would apologize, but I'm sorry I don't have the audio that I hoped I would, because there's a lot of interesting interviews I've gotten from folks on the streets, ranging from Cooper's incredible experiences in court as she fought a year old, where she was assaulted by police officers, by her account, and instead she was charged with resisting arrest, the blanket charge used to cover police misconduct in many jurisdictions, including